Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Sylvia Foster, and our minister, Kendra Ford, is away at a conference this week. So I'm pleased to welcome you and say that this morning you get to hear some of the voices of Fuse. You'll hear writers, musers, philosophers, historians, and observers of life on this spinning blue planet. We need our writers to remind us to notice the world and to help us transform our ordinary days into times of connection and presence. Listen deeply this morning. Rest in the voices of your fellow seekers.
Good morning. I'm pleased to say that this poem is included in my first book of poetry, Facing the Elements, which is being published this month by the Burnham Press. Some of you have heard it before. I wrote it for the occasion of my son Peter's wedding to Monica Krebs Friedrichs this past summer, which we were honored to host in the field behind our house along the tidal Squamscott River. It was a loving event. In anticipation of that celebration, I had enjoyed paying particular attention as our meadow came to life that year and matured, a cycle which, believe it or not, will begin again in a short month and a half from now. It's called This Meadow, August 23rd, 2014. Life steps into this meadow after river ice melt, birthing peepers, then crickets in vernal assault, spilling daisies and lilies, then fireflies that pop before mice and mosquitoes join the midsummer feast, and tall grass crowned by goldenrod and royal queen's lace, with milkweed prepared for its downy release. We gather pollinated families in this sanctified field over the fat gopher's lair, summer's promise fulfilled. After mist clears the river under the osprey's keen gaze, while dragonflies hover and butterflies flutter, the marsh grass dances in the afternoon breeze till the red fox pauses in the spotlight of sunset, recalling the chill of late August nights. We watch changing tides roll toward winter, like the quick-footed chipmunk stealing seed to his den. We are prepared by this bounty for the lean times to come.
Good morning. So I realized I was sort of asked to maybe say something about this poem before I read it, and I don't think I have anything to say about that. I think it speaks for itself. But I do want to say that it's just truly lovely to be here and to be able to see all of your faces, and it just feels absolutely lovely to be able to read this poem to you. This poem is called Playing Ukulele at the Base of the Volcano. O great, unknowable God, I feel for you. Shrouded in the infinite as Hashem, Yahweh, Adonai, I imagine you must feel like that kid, you know, the one born of two parents who each have hyphenated surnames. You must have a lot of empathy for little Eric Jones hyphen O'Malley hyphen Gutierrez hyphen Smith, or Leah Cardin slash Cohen slash Levi slash Rabinowitz. What must the first day of school be like for kids under all that pressure to be so important? So listen, when I call out, O God, Goddess, the universe, and everything, believe me, I perceive you are unfathomable, and distinctly so. Not in the way Eric or Aaliyah's kindergarten teacher feels their parents' decisions to basically let it ride in the naming department defy understanding. As she mumbles, I cannot, in God's name, comprehend how I am going to get through this school year. Trying not to think of the endless conferences and phone calls and emails that will likely insert themselves between herself and these kids she is trying to teach. And I am completely beholden to you, O Magnificence, when I call you, for example, deity of all that is holy and whose wonderment must have inspired chocolate, yet who is merciful and who did not smite me with an unfortunate allergy to it. And I am your supplicant who regards you, maybe not with awe, because let's face it, I think you and I both remember the day a couple years ago when the State Department finally got confirmation on Assad's use of chemical weapons. Did you think it was what exactly? Such a comfort to the cold-bodied Syrian men, women, and children lying unclaimed and mutilated in the makeshift morgues because their tattered families had fled their homes? As I recall, it was a particularly wondrous summer morning to walk early in the woods, to watch the sunrise above the river. I was out early enough that I even surprised a beaver who slapped the surface of the water with her tail, in warning to all the other beavers, or to me, to be on guard. I gasped, delighted. On the drive back to the house, NPR prefaced their report with an admonition that the news would be graphic, and it was. And I yelped like a wild animal shot in the leg. Then loudly, with profanities and sobbing, I basically told you you weren't helping. Another vicious stand-in for humanity. Another people in exile. Millions suffering. Again, pretty derivative, El Jefe. Just curious, when do you expect us to be able to bear up in a world that is so vulnerable to its own? When do we start to get it pointed in the right direction? Many say you are either everything or you are nothing, which, hey, believe me, I get it, it's a lot of pressure on anyone, let alone a deity. I can grasp at least that, O supreme bowling champion of the celestial realms. There are a lot of moving parts here in this earthly realm, a lot of players here, but also a lot of mornings and afternoons and evenings when we wait around feeling stood up by you, by hope, and the world is just a cup of coffee in front of us. The afternoon I left the music store after my ukulele lesson, my first, the one I'd almost canceled twice, I felt so light, so unaware of the bitterness of the cold. It had been fun. I felt holy in my silliness, or silly in my holiness. That is, until I returned to the office and to the news of Je Suis Charlie, and the latest, that being a kosher market full of carnage on a good Shabbos, where people, possibly as joy-filled as me, had died. As quickly as you can slip on ice and right yourself, chuckling, muttering, oh no, not today, today's not that day. And the ones that didn't die quickly, I felt their grasp on life reach into my heart and stay, gripping the last few notes of music that I'd risked. And they hung on. They hung on tightly. Yet I did not ask you for an accounting of it. O dominatrix of mystery, O you who we can safely say has heard it all, O you, our blessed lady that is less Carol Brady, more Alice, O you, great producer of a whimsical musical for the whole family, which has generated really good buzz and maybe even an Oscar nod, The music did not stop. I'd just showed up to my lesson on an icy Friday. When we opened our lawn chairs at the base of the volcano, I did wonder a smidge. And when I stopped wondering after the eruption, the massive, massive eruption that instantly laid me to waste and also made me feel just the slightest bit embarrassed about my previous obsession with Pompeii, when the pyroclastic flow gave way to lava and the lava gave way to more lava, in all the ash and smoke and death and screaming, I was pressed back into earthly materials in a hot second. No breathing in and out or canceling the lesson this time, because I didn't even have the will to cough. Besides, my lungs weren't working. Oh, great data plan of unlimited infinity, this is what I do know. Oh, talented realtor of eternity who does well in both buyers and sellers markets, you are embedded into moments when we cannot cough, nor breathe, nor act on our own behalf. You're in the soil with us, in the lemon crop our bones will bring to the next generations. You're in the knowing of the taste of lemon, the crisp joy it snaps free when the pulp ignites the first taste bud or a drop coolly lands upon a flesh cheek, when molecules of juice leap from a piece of peel just ripped from the fruit, ready to be as nascent as a belly laugh or to be translated into sighs. In my tears, in my widest smiles, there you are. You live in my heart where others take hold, and you have told me your name.
I would like to invite you into a time of meditation or listening to the world. For the meditation, I'm going to read a very brief poem that I wrote. Just a few words of introduction to that poem. It's called Loonlight. I first heard a loon call almost 50 years ago when I stood for the first time on land that we had bought on the shore of a lake in northwest Maine. And I didn't know what to make of it. I'd never heard anything like that before. I'd heard about it. And so before long, I figured, well, that must be a loon. And of course, since that time, I've heard a lot of loon calls. I've learned to distinguish between them and their meanings. I've learned about how the loon captures oxygen in its blood and stores it in its blood so that it can release that oxygen slowly while the loon is underwater. And that allows the loon to stay underwater much longer than it possibly could just by holding its breath. I learned about how long loons have been here since the time of the dinosaurs. They have been here all this time. And hopefully they'll be here much longer as well. So here's a little poem that I will ask you to meditate upon if you care to, or just listen to whatever world is within you. And then we'll have some silence. Water has captured the evening sky. Moonlight blesses the inward eye. From deepest past, a clear call comes. and the stillness succumbs. This sound will yet for eons rend the silence and suspend the end that I anticipate with awe and fright and envy of careless calls at night. Do loons know, as do I, that as we live, we shall die? Heedless of such mystery, they yet proclaim, "My God, for me."
Good morning. I have a couple of poems. They're seasonal poems. The first one is called Even When It's Warm, It's Cold. It was inspired by looking at the snow. And every now and then you probably have seen, shades of blue or some type of a blue aspect to the snow. And I was looking at that, and I was just wondering, where does the blue come from? And I think I raised the question one time in a science class. And I think one student said, it's probably just the reflection of the sky. I said, oh, and maybe you're onto something. Maybe that is what it is. So this is called Even When It's Warm, It's Cold. And it goes to a place where I wasn't expecting. I've seen one color of the sky and snow and polar ice, where creatures living there don't seem to mind the sting of frozen air. They swim and fish as deep as they can go in water colder than the ice is blue. They dive for breakfast, lunch, and when they're through, they preen their feathers till their coats are dry. When eggs are laid to halt the loss of heat, males balance them for months above their feet. The females hear their partner's lengthy cry when they return from catching fish to swap the inborn roles they play as mom and pop. The huddled chicks stay warm until they're grown. They find their mates about the age of 3, then role reverse and start a family. The destiny of youth is sometimes known. For Arctic birds, it's clear, despite the cold, their folks are who they'll mimic when they're old. And this is a poem. It's called Patience. It's about the trees. The trees stood still. They knew enough to wait. They knew that every season wasn't great for blooming, so they slowed down and they dreamed of what the light would feel like when it streamed for hours in the warmth of a summer day. When asked if they felt cold, they wouldn't say. But given the chance, they wore a coat of snow and waited for the length of days to grow. They watched the squirrels and chipmunks fetch their meals, but never spoke a word of how it feels to while away the time and not complain, or worry if the forest would sustain their young, or fret about the need for room. Instead, they held out for a chance to bloom.
I'll read my poem first and then give some comments. Will. Our cat Wilford hated water. He left the pond to the frogs. He walked a more than just safe distance from any sink. Deeply offended by the odd flying droplet, he was revolted by the human who would splash the stuff. Apparently a skilled herder in his first life, he brought our car into the driveway at night. As we approached home late, there was Will, loyal as love can be, but mostly hopeful about our headlights meeting his vision. Unless, of course, it was raining, when his calling was to defend the porch. When Will got frail, he inspired fancy buffets and the frumpiest of bedclothes, where he would nap and purr, but backwards. His song seemed more of a question of us. Wilford found delight in the creature that flies, but was merely philosophical about that tired old piece of string they dangle overhead. There was no changing Wilford's mind. And water was something he steadfastly disapproved of. Until one day, he walked out the garage door, and I followed, to a low stream bed, where he stepped into the water, first one paw, then another, until he was all in, looking to the beyond, and there was longing in his voice. We thank any friend for such communion. People who love animals spend a lot of time with them, and they often start to feel that there's more to them than meets the eye. They just don't know what that is or how to explain it. They believe, as researchers do, that animals are probably doing a lot of genius things right under our noses, and we just don't know it. One thing most of us recognize is that the other creatures' sensory worlds are much richer than ours. Perhaps we have the potential to be more perceptive, but we're not yet. At the most basic level, of course, we're all connected. David Suzuki has said, "Every breath is an affirmation of our connection with all other living things." People and other animals are supposed to be together. We spent a long time evolving with them as emotional beings, and humans are just not human without other animals. Temple Grandin tells us that she hopes her work will encourage people to start over again with animals and begin to think about them in a different way. She says, it's time to start seeing animals as capable and communicative beings. It's time to stop making assumptions, like researchers take it for granted that animals don't have language or animals don't have psychological awareness. There are a lot of assertions. The truth is, generally speaking, we don't know what animals can't do any better than we know what they can do. If we're interested in them, then we need to study them for their own sake. What are they doing? What are they feeling? What are they saying? And what do we need to do to treat animals fairly and responsibly and with kindness? Mystics from various religious traditions have in common the experience of feeling themselves with one that, with all that exists. Mystics suggest that the creation of the other is false. It's a false dichotomy, and that it will keep us from love and compassion for others and from the deepest understanding of the self. How could I ever label our companion animal, Kita, as an other? She filled our days with soulfulness and her adorable stubbornness. Our friend Kita had a ministry, and that was to tell us how she felt each day. She had a rich emotional life because dogs do. We always enjoyed hearing her talk about what was happening. We turned to hear her when she had her wolfy expressions of hope that maybe a friend would come and talk to her. Songs of ecstasy, mostly for beef tripe, and howls for people that she longed to be with. In addition to her outward communications, Kita had a ministry to listen. When I was sad, she would look into my eyes without a sound. It was just Keita's eyes to mine, primitive and knowing. I learned from her that this simple wordless response is how to hold someone's grieving soul in my heart. I have become a better human being from following the knowing and primitive reflections in my dear Will's and Keita's eyes.
I first met Olive Tardif back when I was first hired at the Exeter Historical Society as curator. She was a historian. She wrote many things. She wrote a series of paperback books. She wrote the history of women in New Hampshire. She wrote about Henry Shute, who was an Exeter author. She wrote about the rivers, which is where I became very closely connected with her work. She volunteered for the Historical Society, and this is when I got to know her. She volunteered with her friend Thelma Barlow. They were in what I would call the 90-plus club, both born in the 19-teens, good friends, both from Exeter originally. And as the working historian on duty, it was very easy for me because I could spend hours looking up at a piece of information. So if somebody called me and said, hey, when did they pave the streets? I could take a long time to do it, or I could ask Thelma and Olive. And the two of them would then bicker back and forth for a while, and they'd make me clarify, you mean when they oiled the streets? I remember them doing that. And then, you know, eventually I'd get an answer. They were a wonderful resource. Olive also kept track of me very closely. She called me on Saturday mornings a lot in recent years to talk about what she had seen that I'd written and clarify things and suggest things and chide me in a grandmotherly way to get things done. When Kendra asked me to read some of Olive's poetry, I was a bit surprised and said, Olive wasn't a poet, she was a historian. And Kendra said, well, see if you can find something, you know, maybe something about the river that's lyrical, because she was a very good writer. So I went through the files, and one of the first things I found was a booklet that Olive, someone had put together for Olive of in 2010 of her poetry. And in it, calling me from the grave, was a note from Olive that said, and I'm going to try to do her voice if I can, Barbara. I thought you might like this for the files. So clearly she was keeping track of me again. I have two pieces I will read for you now. The first one we'll dedicate to all writers everywhere. It's called Bread Upon the Waters. Writers and fisher folk are much the same. We cast our lines abroad with careful aim. Indeed, our fondest aspirations match. We're hoping for a nibble, or better yet, a catch. Whatever course our earnest offering traces, we pray our lines will fall in profitable places. The piece I really wanted to read for you, which is a good ending piece for such a good poetic day, is called Time to Retire. Olive and her husband, Joe, retired a little earlier than most people, because they had a mission. They wanted to travel, and they did. Joe traveled a lot. Olive followed along behind him, but she wrote down what he was up to. Here are her thoughts on retirement. Time to retire. Retired, they ask, but what do you do? Don't the days seem long, your pleasures few? Don't you miss those old pals back at the plant who collect paychecks while you gallivant? We look at each other and chuckle deep. It's great in the morning to get more sleep, to loll on the beach when the day is hot, or sit by the fireside when it is not. We practice hobbies, we read and walk. We finish our chores, then sit and talk. There's church, there are clubs, there are joys galore. When one thing's over, we look for more. You'll never know till you try it yourself. It doesn't mean that you're put on the shelf. If we stay as busy as we have been, we'll have to retire all over again. Olive and Thelma would volunteer on Saturday mornings until noon, and then at noon they would leave together to go out for lunch. And they had ice cream only for lunch every Saturday afternoon. He told me that once you're 90, you can do that.